Okay, this is continuing on October 31st. James Boyd and Eleanor Swim. Okay.
So he made me his executive officer, and I gave up the membership on the Program Adjustment Committee. Mm-hmm. Now, the people in charge of the production division were people like Denton, Frank Denton, who later became the president, and George Wood, his assistant, who was the top man in the first of Boston Corporation. And after the war, I tried to get him to come to Germany with me to run that thing. He went on to become the president of the World Bank. Mm. And they couldn't understand how I could be so close to Clay. And obviously, I exerted power. Many times they would call me, and I would listen, and particularly George Woods was very smart about this. He would say, well, now, we've got this, we've got that. What do you think the general would say? And I said, I think the general will say this. Be seeing you, and off you go and do it. Hmm. I always reported these things, these conversations to Clay, because we knew each other so thoroughly that I knew I could speak for him. And never once did I ever to go back and change it. So that association was so great. And then, but this was put me in a position that I went to the War Production Board, not the production division, as we represent over there, and the Commons Committee. They felt they ought to be there. And they wanted me out of there. And they wanted me to take over the conservation division of the production and the Almonds. But Clay, and later, when Clay went to Europe, Mr. Bruce kept me on. But they never believed that I didn't have some sort of pull. When I came to Washington, I didn't know a soul in town but the main photographer in town, which was George Harris. Harrison Ewing, remember? You've heard of Harrison Ewing.
Uh-huh, I have.
He was a great friend of Ruth's father, and they were the only people we knew in Washington.
Really?
I had never met anybody in the Army. Later on, one of my classmates came in, but he was in some other division. Mm-hmm. But so anything that occurred to me, it wasn't come because I knew anybody before. Yeah. It was only because I was able to demonstrate some sort of understanding and be able to get things done, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Must have been.
And but there was some resentment about it.
I suppose.
But they all remained my friends, so I guess it wasn't a very serious one. Mm-hmm. Then, when things began to straighten out in Europe, and had a terrible time getting Cherbourg straightened around. The flow of stuff wasn't coming into Cherbourg, and it needed to back up the army going into Germany and down to Austria and to Bavaria and so forth. Sent for Clay to come and straighten out Cherbourg. That meant that Mr. Howard Bruce came in. And Howard Bruce was the chairman of the board of the First National Bank of Baltimore. That was, I gave you the name, Bruce. Yeah.
Yeah, now he came in Washington.
He came and took Clay's place when he went to Cherbourg.
To Cherbourg. Mm-hmm.
And then, I stayed on as an executive officer.
You continued as Bruce's.
Bruce's executive officer.
Executive officer.
And we became very close friends, of course. Mm-hmm. I'll show you later on how close it was. And my relationship with Howard was almost as good as it was with Clay.
Mm-hmm. Now, was he also, he wasn't in the Army?
No, he was a civilian. Mm-hmm. It was Mr. Howard Bruce. And, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there was was in the organ, out of the organization. We didn't really care. I don't suppose more than a third of the officers in Clay's staff were regular Army officers. Mm-hmm. The rest of us were reserve officers like I was, or assimilated officers, were given the commission. Mm-hmm. For instance, Milt came to Clay. Have I told you how Milt came in there?
No, I don't think
Clay so. Called me in one day and he said, you've got an assistant. I've been needing an assistant, but I've been looking. And I said, that's so. And he gave me this piece of paper, showed me this man's history. And he had been a director of or a trustee of one of the universities down in Houston. And but he'd been the president of Jesse Jones's insurance company. I said to Clay, well, what do you want another professor along here for? He said, well, he's good enough for Jesse Jones, he's good enough for me. Mm-hmm. Well, with great reluctance, I took Milt on. And he was just superb. He had no children, and he had a lovely southern wife who we call every birthday, rather than now, even now. And he would be out working all day long and getting this information, checking and seeing that what we said was right and it was the right thing to do. So he was really the mechanism that made me so acceptable, I think. Quite sure, but he was just simply for it. Mm-hmm. And so he stayed on with Bruce, too. Mm-hmm. But when I, then Clay, one day, Mr. Bruce called me and said, well, the first time General Clay had been back in Washington. They called him when the Schoenberg was straightened out, much to his disgust. He was brought back to Washington to be Jimmy Burns' assistant. Jimmy Burns was in the White House. He'd been in the Supreme Court, and he was doing much to rehabilitate. And before this, before Clay went to Schoenberg, he had seen the end of the war coming. And while we were worrying about VJ Day or VE Day and so forth, Clay was in here working away. And I'd go in worrying about VJ Day. And I made some remark one day, and he said, Jim, he said, we can't do anything to help MacArthur or Eisenhower now. Well, if we hadn't done it 3 years ago, then we can't do anything now. Mm-hmm. So he was here planning reconversion. Mm-hmm. And General Draper, this one, was came General in.
Draper.
And he, with Admiral, who got into trouble over atomic energy,
Rickover.
Huh? No, not Rickover.
He was
important to atomic energy, but Rickover hadn't even shown on the scene, then. Okay. I didn't know him then. He'd been in the financial field too. Well, I remember him more.
Okay.
They planned the reconversion period. They saw that they had to have contract cancellations and negotiations so that the companies could give up their contracts and immediately get converted and make VE loans so that they could have the money to reconvert their plants to civilian production. And then out in the field was John Fenley with the Committee on Economic Development in each of the major cities around, that were seeing what that city could do towards domestic production. They could see we needed what we needed. We needed automobiles and beds and all the things you need, and building materials and so on.
And this all started well before the end of the
war. Well before the end of the war. But when Eisenhower began to move through Europe, they were getting right out of ammunition. We had underestimated, the planners underestimated the fire pit, the rate of speed of fire, we were shooting off to have the ammunition much faster than we did. So we were really running out, and we got to the Battle of the Bulge, if you remember. Now, the general in charge of that unit in the Battle of the Bulge had been in our requirements division under Clay's office. Mm. And he got off and got command of that. So that made my mind go somewhere else. Yeah.
We were running out of ammunition.
Yeah. So Somerville called me in and said, you go up to New York and sit down with the boys in Wall Street. And Harry Morgan, knowing everybody in Wall Street, went with me. And then go down to New Orleans, where Bill Green is having his convention, and convince them that we needed more ammunition. Mm-hmm. And then go up to Pittsburgh and see Phil, head of the steelworkers. So I got in the airplane and I flew down there, but what I had were the eyes only telegraph. And I went to see Bill Green, and I got
there.
This
was one of the Union?
Yeah, he was the president of the FAL. Another man I'm trying to think of was the president of the steelworkers. And Phil Murray. Mm. And I got down there early in the morning, and I went to the hotel where I knew where Bill Green was. And I got in touch with his secretary, and I told him who I was, and I told her. And she said, well, the president would like you to have breakfast with him. So I went up with the president, and we sat down, and I showed him these telegrams, and I said, if you can do what you can to see that we're really serious about going back to make ammunition. Okay. So I climbed on the airplane, and I went up to Pittsburgh, and I got to there again. I got early in the morning to Phil Murray's office, and he hadn't come back from Washington yet. He came over on the train. So I tried to, I hadn't been out of uniform yet. And so Phil came in, and I showed him, and we talked a while, and he put his feet up on the table. He was a very nice guy. And I showed him this thing. He said, do what he could. Then I dropped in the plane from Pittsburgh and went up to New York and got hold of Harry Morgan, and he introduced me to the powers that be on Wall Street. And I showed him the cables again. Then we took by this time the weather closed in. So I had to take a train down, and Harry was coming down too, so we got through his influence, we got ourselves a drawing room. So we climbed on the train, and we got the drawing room, and there were all the black boys quartered around. Yes, Mr. Who was the fighter in those days?
Oh dear, I don't know.
Well, he was the great champion of the time.
Joe Lewis?
Joe. Yeah, it was Joe.
Really?
Mr. Lewis, yeah, that's right. Oh. And they had put him down in this cabin, but they had to get him out and find another seat so we could get him. I'm just glad he didn't want to fight that seat.
Oh.
He was a sergeant in the army. And, I was a colonel. So anyway, we went in and had our trip back to Washington.
Now, you had to get extra financing? Was this?
No. We really had seen the end of the war. We hadn't realized how in order to get there, we'd been using ammunition faster than our mm-hmm. plans had laid out.
Mm-hmm.
The result is we began to run out, and this Battle of the Bulge had given us food for thought. So we had to get ammunition started again. As it turned out, it didn't do any good because none of that got over before the war.
Oh.
So this went somewhere to the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
And,
But you had really stopped shipping ammunition to Europe?
Well, slowed it down. Our pipelines were beginning to get weak.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there's an enormous pipeline from the from production plant through inspection lines, through the railroad trains to get to the ships, to be piled up ready to go on a ship to be taken across there. People don't realize there's an awful long pipeline of material from the production into the gun that shoots it off.
Well, I think it's interesting that you went to the Union people rather than to the corporation people.
Oh, we went to both.
I see.
I happened to go to see the Union people first. Because that was where it was set up.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I was sitting in airplanes all night long, and I was ready to go to bed when I got home.
Contracts that had to be revamped were with
with
industries.
Yeah. I went to Wall Street because those on Wall Street were close enough, including Harry Morgan, were the leaders of industry, that they could have some on boards and so forth, and they could convey them without showing those secret cables to too many people. They could convey in the urgency and they could be trusted with it. And that was the reason for doing it.
I see. So General Clay was back in Washington at this time in another capacity.
Yeah, well, no. Now we're getting him back. He'd been in Cherbourg, he got that straightened out, and they brought him back to work on the reconversion, you see, under under Justice I gave you the name earlier.
Draper?
No, Justice. No. She wasn't the Justice Supreme Court who came out.
Burns.
Burns. And so he worked with them. And then I was sitting down one day in the where was I? Well, I was over in the Pentagon building with General Draper. And he came in and said, Roosevelt is dead. I remember, much as I disliked the man, I never saw him. I was this far away from him in the line of command, but I was just as shocked as if I had lost a close friend. By this time, Clay had gone to Europe. He had been appointed to be the deputy military governor under Eisenhower, and. No, this is before, wait a minute, let me get this correlation straight. He had asked me before he went over there whether I would come. He called me down one day, and Bruce had said to me, well, the general will want you, you know, over there. Well, it hadn't occurred to me that he would. But I went home and I said to Ruth, I said, Bruce says that Lucius will want me over in Germany. Well, she didn't hesitate a minute. She said, well, it's a very important job, and if he needs you, you're going to have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the very next day, he called me down to a little office he had in the Pentagon building. He said, Jim, you go to Germany? I said, yes, sir. So I have to ask Howard Bruce. I said, I think it'll be all right.
Uh-huh.
So he talked to Howard that afternoon, and the next morning he called me up again. He said, didn't you understand what I said yesterday? I said, yes, sir. Didn't you understand what I said? Well, he says, I don't know what kind of job you'll have, but I assure you it'll tax your abilities. So I didn't know any more about it, and then he went over there, and within 10 days, he sent for me. So I had to pack Ruth up, and Milt took charge, and he saw off the transportation and getting this thing packed up. And Ruthie put the five children and the maid on the car, and put the boat on a train on a boat to go down to Williamsburg so she could sail to Williamsburg before she trekked west to Denver. But in the meantime, we had rented our house in Denver to some people in the restaurant business were afraid of being out on the coast. It's too close to Japan. Oh. And by this time, they saw that was over, so they had gone back to the coast, and so our house was empty, so Ruthie could go back there. And then he arranged for it. Now let me get myself in.
So you were going back over then to Germany to join General Kraft.
So he wanted me right away. So I think it took us 4 or 5 days for me to pack up and get and have Milt take her over, and have Bruce had already approved my transfer. And I get on a plane, and
what kind of plane did you fly?
Well, there was 4 engines, propeller-driven planes. Mm-hmm. They could cross the Atlantic in one or two jumps. I think we had to go up to
Newfoundland
and gas up and then go across the North Park. Mm-hmm. But we had to come across the coast. Thank you, Don. We had to come across the coast in France. Yes, Don, thank you. And we got shot at. We could see the shells working below us.
Did you really?
And, but they weren't anywhere near. Mm-hmm. But because Eisenhower had bypassed those ports and didn't waste energy driving the Germans out there. They had German troops left behind on ammunition. Mm-hmm. But they weren't doing any harm. They contained them and went by. Mm-hmm. And we landed in Orly Field, and the plane had to go between shell holes on the runway. Mm. And but they were 4-engine planes. I've forgotten the number of them. C-54 or something like that. Yeah. But they were bucket seats.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have a very uncomfortable trip across there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I arrived in Saint-Cloud. A colonel friend of mine met me, sent his car to pick me up. And I took me in I stayed with him in a beautiful chalet in Saint-Cloud. And the office was what's the palace, south of France, Paris, Versailles.
Versailles.
That's where the Chafe back headquarters were, mm-hmm. And that's where I had to check in. And I got on the phone, and Clay was up at, by this time, was up in Rouen. And I said, here I am, what do I do? He said, you come up here. And so I said to my colonel friend, how am I going to get up? He said, you'll take my car, my driver will take you up there. So I had to go and buy this up to. Well, not Saint Cloud, not it's one room. And this was Chafe headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in to see Clay, and I said, here I am, what do I do? He says, you're in charge of German industry. I said, what do I do? He said, that's your problem, Colonel. I said, well, now do I report to you? He said, no, I haven't got the authority. I've not been appointed, but this is the middle of Uganda yet. You're going to work for Bob Crawford, who's G4. The G4 is the supply side of staff. So I went and reported to General Crawford. And he had me set up as a special branch chief in Chafe headquarters. And I said, what's the policy? He says, it's your problem, Colonel. But then he said, you read in there somewhere in these books, and you will if you're interested in this thing, that we were ruled by a Joint Chiefs of Staff document called JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, 1067, not 1066, 1067, mm-hmm. which was put together by Morgenthau, who was Secretary of Treasury and Jewish. So he was all for really subjugating Germany. We call it the pastoralization of Germany. Mm-hmm. And the military government people had taken this and worked out what they ought to do. So I get up to Schaeff, and Clay is still back in Saint-Cloud. And
how do you spell?
I'm confused a little bit here. I'll have to check this out.
C-L-U?
No. C-L-O, we'll have to get Clay
together. I'll have
to
find that out.
Yeah. It's a, but it was near Versailles.
Mm-hmm.
And but Clay was up in Shape Forward. And I said, now, what do I do? He said, that's your problem. What's my organization structure? Well, he said, you're going to be with Bobby Crawford. And you'll be in his staff, and you'll be in charge of German industry. I said, what's the policy? He said, that's your problem. Then someone handed me JCS 1067. Then I read this and I said, well, now I've got to have some help. I don't even know how to read this stuff. And I said, I want Colonel so-and-so, who was a great lawyer and later became the chief lawyer for the Rockefeller Brothers in New York, Don McLean. And Clay says, you can't have him, I need him. I said, well, you tell me you haven't got a job yet. Can I have him until you get a job? So he allowed that was sound. So Don came up to Rouen. And I would work all day getting staff together and place to work and dealing with New York about sending me people to run this and that and the other. And he would go reading the JCS 1067 and finding out what the policy was, and he'd come and sit on my bed at night to give me the night treatment. And I finally got a room in the general officer's hotel, which is the Lyon d'Or, where Ike used to come for his meals. Mm-hmm. If he wasn't staying, he had a chalet or someplace he'd stay in. And it was there I worked from until I could get an office set up in Frankfurt. Well, at that point, we hadn't crossed the Rhine yet, you know.
Yeah.
And I used to go and see the war room. Let me see, where am I?
Well, you...
This
would have been...
No, this was before we crossed the Rhine. This was, by now we were, just about this time we crossed the Rhine. So I moved up to Frankfurt.
So this is what,
but then I didn't have any staff up there, you see.
March, April of 45?
No, I can't remember.
No.
It was about that, right.
Was it winter?
April of 45.
Spring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I didn't have any help. I didn't have any staff. We had this thing to do, and I did. I had Don to help me do things out.
Of course, you couldn't run over to Germany and get the information.
Well, that's right. Well, however, by this time we had crossed the Rhine.
Uh-huh.
When I was talking about it, went up there. And then they bought me, a man who became a great friend, as a British brigadier. Because this was Schaeff forward, see, and mm-hmm. Schaeff was a mixture of British and American officers. Mm-hmm. And this was my officer number, and I was a senior officer, although he was a brigadier and I was a colonel. And but we didn't have any problem with that. And we were walking. Then I got, have you seen this new picture of they have on Georgie Patton?
No, I haven't watched
well,
it.
Well, Georgie was now down in Bavaria, and he was setting himself up as a king in Bavaria. And he wasn't paying any attention to what I wanted at all, and what Clay wanted. We wanted to reestablish the monetary system so things could, trade could go on naturally. But while I was in Rouen, the armistice came, or the surrender came. Mm-hmm. And my office, as I was in there, the only office available to me was the office of a British Lieutenant General who was home on leave. And that was right underneath the war room, so I had that office. And one of the colonels came in to me and he said, well, this is it. And these two German officers went by upstairs to the war room to surrender. But Ike wouldn't have anything to do with them. He'd been up to Buchenwald, and I saw him when he came back from Buchenwald. And I'd had a nail I'd put in front of his teeth. I'm sure he would have bitten. I never saw a man so angry as that one. It was a brutal thing to see. And he wouldn't deal with them. So poor Beadle Smith had to do it. He was this Eisenhower's deputy, had to deal with it. And Ike would stay down in his office, and Beadle would go back and ask him questions over here and over again. So that meant the war was essentially over in Europe. It wasn't long after that that I began to find out that I wasn't easy to work with because I didn't have enough rank. So I talked to Clay about it. I thought they wanted to be a general, but I didn't get the job done. And he wouldn't let me have this one I wanted. I suggested. Maybe it was a good thing. Georgie Patton was acting up. He was beginning to trade across the border with Czechoslovakia. Not trade, but barter. Mm-hmm. So I was sent down there to remonstrate with him. And I get down, when you go to the Georgie's zone, you had to put on your polished helmet liner, and you had to have your boots polished. We never had wore boots at all, you know. Mm-hmm. I carried one of my friends, the ordnance, gave me a Belgian shoulder holster. That was all the artillery I carried. Mm-hmm. And so I had to get dolled up and go down to see General Patton. And I arrived there, and the G4 met me, and his name was Mueller. He was quite a character. He had an orchestra, a beautiful German string orchestra, go with him everywhere at any meal. And now this time they'd conquered Bavaria. And he loved music. And he told me a story about how U.S. and the bees up there are telling us we've got to feed the German soldiers down here. He said, you got to feed yourself off the land. He said, well, there's no food down here to eat, and we're not going to stay down here and see these guys die of hunger. They'll get army rations. Well, I went on and talked to him about what we were supposed to do, and we went over to see the general, and he had this big, nothing like this in the picture. He had an office, and it was quite long, as long as this house, I guess. Mm-hmm. I had to walk a full length of it to go to his office and talk to him. Well, anyway, I remonstrated with him and said we ought to do this thing properly. And then it was Friday night, and I had to be back in Berlin Saturday because Clay expected us, all the division commanders, to be there on Saturday morning. And he apologized and sent me with his L-5 plane to go down to the Bavarian airport. And this youngster put his wingtip down on the runway and spun it around and stopped the plane that was already beginning to take off and put me aboard. Ah. There was no radar, no signal system. You flew up to Berlin, there was any fog, you flew blind up there to Tempelhof. Sometimes I had to go up in Beetle Smith's plane, and sometimes it was a regular plane going up there.
Mm-hmm. Just a second till this gets... Okay, so...
Anyway, we're getting a lot of political pressure. The newspaper reporters were reporting that we were using the Nazis and all this kind of stuff.
You mean American newspapers back home?
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Then there was one newspaper article that came that drew to my attention, and let me get the story straight. He was telling me how we down in Nuremberg that we were putting German industry back before we got the industry started in the United States. I said, "Have you been down to Nuremberg?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, then you better go down there with me, don't you? There's obviously a stick moving or rock standing on each other. The only place building that's left in Nuremberg is the building where we're holding the trials." I said, and so he did go down and see it, and later on he apologized. Well, anyway, when I got back from Bavaria, I was a reporter came in to see Ronnie and me, and we talked about it, told him what we were doing and so forth. And then, after we had finished talking, we were standing looking out the window, and I mentioned this problem about not feeding the German soldiers down in Bavaria. And they thought more about it. Next day, they popped. The PRO called me up and said, "Have you seen this thing going back to New York?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you better get down there." So I flew down to Paris, hunted this reporter up at the Scream Hotel, and I said, "Is there any way you can stop this? It's gone back to New York." I said, "Can't you stop it somewhere? I mean, it isn't true. We've got a hard enough time getting this thing going. This kind of story is going to make it very tough." So then I went over to see the ambassador. He was chairman of the board of one of the big insurance companies. It's coming. Douglas. Lewis Douglas. I'd met Lou before, and I told him what I wanted to do, and he was very worried about all this kind of thing. But the reporter said he'd do all he could. He'd call you and came back. And I went right back it was Reims, where we had back, or
not Rouen.
Not Rouen.
Okay.
I knew I was wrong. Rance, the proper pronunciation. And I went in to see Clay, and I said, look, what's happened? He says, can you read more about it? I said, no. He says, well, go back to work, forget it. Well, somehow or other, it never appeared. So you asked me how I thought of Clive Clay. That's the kind of man he was. Uh-huh. These are examples. I mean, some of the wonderful men. We understood each other. We never fought. Mm. We never gainsaid each other. Somehow or other, we were able to come to the same conclusions and understood each other. So we never had any. The only time that I had a problem is before Clay had really got started, when the Munitions Board was still active, Ferdinand Eberstadt had a meeting, and there was a man named in the Sun Secretary's office named Bob Reed, I think his name was. And another colonel and I, and the commander of the Navy, and Bob, went over and spent 3 days with the people in the War Production Board to try and get them to do what we wanted done. In order. Now we're going back, this is long before I went to Germany.
Right. Mm-hmm.
To find a way to make the allocations of materials follow the programs that we needed to do. So we were sure that the materials were going where the airplane was being built, the tank was being built, and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been worked out in Army Industrial Board, warrant system in which warrants would be issued for steel or for copper or what it may be, and you'd pass it down the line. And we listened, by this time the War Production Board had set up the production requirements plan. And I went to the first meeting of this thing. There, in their infinite wisdom, they're going to take everybody's orders, and they were going to decide who would get how much steel, how much copper, and so forth. Well, it was quite obvious to me that you could never deal in that detail with all the materials, everything like besides the people, the things that really control the programs were steel, copper, and aluminum. If you control these, you can control the programs. And so I came back to a meeting, and there was Fred Eberstadt and Clay and Admiral Robinson and around this table. And they debated this question, and really Bob really described what we were up against. And as I was coming back there, I said to Bob, is there something the matter with me? I mean, these people use words I don't understand at all. He said, well, they're in the New Deal. They live together, they work together, almost slept together, and the words mean something different to them than mean to ordinary people. And it was full of all kinds of stuff that I wouldn't understand. But in the meantime, I'd been studying very carefully how they were allocating the copper to go into the munitions program. And they were doing it pretty well along the line of the warrant plan. So after a long discussion, Clay turned to me and said, Boyd, what do you think about it? I said, well, they've got this thing set up, General. I think we can get out of it what we want. You sold the army down the river. Gosh, I fell through the floor. And so we, after the meeting, we went up, the four, the colonels and the commanders, and the colonel, who was my senior officer, actually, I began to talk. He said, Jim, you've got your orders. You can't go along with that at all. So I shut up, and the third Eberstadt was there. He said, well, I'll write it up. We'll figure it out somewhere. But we got this plan over. Clay never said another thing about it. I never had any trouble with him about it. Because that was my order, and I didn't do anything against him.
Mm-hmm.
So we got the War Production Board then to adopt this plan, and we call it the materials, it was called the materials requirement plan, where they were going to do all the allocation from some committee in Washington, mm-hmm. to this way you had demands for a system, statistical system, approved by the requirements committee. You pass the money back, or the money in terms of steel and copper and so forth, to the agencies, and they could put that, give it to their contractors, who would cash them in on the mills, so the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was I that had thought up the idea that you didn't need to do this to all materials, that you could do the rest of it by allocation from the War Production Board, like the vanadium and the chromium and the tungsten and things like that, and the cotton duck and the wood and things like that. You couldn't, through the production requirements plan, have the departments of the War Production Board authorize people to consume the material. So I said, so really this is the controlling materials plan. Mm-hmm. Well, it ended up being coined by the controlled materials plan. So I suppose I coined that word.
So
at that point.
Really was your no. plan then that eventually.
Well, no. My plan was the plan of the industrial college. There was a warrant plan. All I did was give it a name which told more clearly,
mm-hmm.
that they weren't giving a warrant for everything. They're giving a wrong warrant for the
certain
materials that would control the programs. Because
mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought about this for 25, 30 years. You know.
It's awfully complicated, isn't it?
I guess I do. Anyway, Lucius sent me out to the districts to educate the procurement officers on this, mm-hmm. what this was. He called this the Boyd University.
So that's the only time you ever disagreed with them, really?
Well, I really didn't disagree with him.
No.
He asked me, and I said, well, they've got this thing set up now. And I believe we can get out of it what we want.
Mm-hmm.
But they had their minds made up that they were going to throw. And when Lucius had his mind made up, it was made up. You didn't.
Right.
And I didn't realize how far along he was.
No.
But since I never gave any trouble with where that, so I guess it didn't.
So did you, when to go back to Germany, did you see a lot of him then when you were there, or were you working on your own now?
Well, when I got there, when I got there back there first, I went up to Ranch.
Yes, but.
And I saw him,
mm-hmm.
and he said, well, I haven't got a job. You got a job, you go to Bobby Crawford's office, and you be part of his office. And he gave me a job as a section commander.
But he had not yet been assigned.
Had been assigned.
I see.
So, because in other words, we were operating under Eisenhower's authority.
Mm-hmm.
He was assigned to be deputy military governor, but there wasn't any job for deputy military governor until we got into Berlin, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they didn't prevent me from going talking to him.
No, no.
So Don and I had to work on our own. In the meantime, we had people back in Washington getting staff for us. So who do they send over? They sent me the president of the Republic Steel Company to take care of steel in my organization. The vice president of the General Motors Company to be my deputy. The vice president of Westinghouse Electric Company to take care of the mill of the electrical systems. The man who I'd worked with, who was in the army, a colonel, would be in charge of the energy systems, the power plants and things like that. So when they came, except for, that's Walker Sisler. This is the guy here. This is
Walker
Sisler, C-I-S-L-E-R. I worked with him in Washington. He had a colonel's rank.
Mm-hmm.
But when he came to Germany to be doing this, he had to report to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there again, there was a close association. He'd be in Paris today and in Berlin tomorrow, and anytime I needed him, he was right there. He had a house in Berlin where he came to visit me.
Where was your office?
Well, I started in Frankfurt, and as soon as we cleared out Berlin, then I moved up to Berlin. It was still smoking when I went up there the first time. We went into the chancellery where Hitler's body was burned. It was hardly cold in there yet.
Hmm.
Soon after that, we were early into Berlin. The Russians were caught already there.
Mm-hmm.
And they ransacked everything and raped all the women.
Hmm.
Because they didn't leave any for us.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Was Frankfurt in better condition than Berlin?
No. In order to get into Frankfurt, there were some buildings left. There was one building which was quite narrow but wide, and the bombs would come down and skip through the building and explode out in the yard out beyond.
Mm.
So the Corps of Engineers were able to repair it. And they did it so quickly that people thought that the thing hadn't even been bombed at all. But we had to have a bulldozer go ahead of us to get through the streets. I was there that close to it.
Mm.
And then the house they gave me to live in was a duplex house, and the other side of the duplex was totally gone.
Mm.
In the attic of my apartment was a place where some fire bombs come through, and then it sputtered out on the tile floor of the attic.
Hmm.
I guess it was full of stuff, but the people had cleaned it up for me, so there was nothing but a bed and some few chairs we just stayed in.
Mm-hmm.
Then what I had to do was to find a place in Berlin, and they assigned me a little house near the Dahlendorf station, right across the street from Dahlendorf station. And they assigned me a tank sergeant to be my chauffeur. He had gotten trench feet, was commanding his men, so they had put him off to a more sedentary job. So he was my driver and my batman and everything else. He ran my whole household for me. And I put him upstairs in the house, but I kept the lady who owned the house, I kept her on and moved her upstairs into the third floor, and we took the best part of the house, of course. And she was delighted. I mean, she didn't speak a word of English, and I had to learn my Deutsch in order to get my Eierkuchen and Speck for breakfast. Frühstück.
She cooked for you?
She cooked for us. And when I left, later on, the tears just streamed out of her eyes. Mm-hmm. Because we had been her home, and she kept it up the way it was, and we didn't make any mess of it.
And in exchange, she got fed, of course.
She got fed. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if we ever exchanged anything, but that was somebody else handled it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, now we're getting here. Let's get back to, we got wandering off. We're still on 1067.
Mm-hmm.
This was the document that's supposed to do it, to arrange it. And you've read somewhere. I guess it's in that book that Timmy's got. I'll show it to you. Because these are the great people I had to work with in those days, and it mentions 1067 in there.
Mm-hmm.
And Clay's reaction to it. And what we had to do was to take that document and get it, get the Joint Chiefs of Staff to change their plans. And Clay would get on the teletype. When he was dealing in my field, I'd go in with him, the teletype, and we'd correspond with the State Department over the teletype. You didn't have a radio or anything like that. You had to type it out, and and you get the reply on the teletype. And that's...
Well...
What are you going to do to your cousins tonight?
Pardon me?
You going to your cousins tonight?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's getting late for you.
Well, I was thinking it might be a good place to stop, okay. And we can... Okay. This is continuing the interview with James Boyd in Carmel on November 1st now, isn't it? In the morning of November 1st.
You asked the question of whether or not what I have been engaged in my life has any relationship to the training I received in the years that I was working as an undergraduate student and in the graduate school at the Colorado School of Mines. We have always in working with students, we had to try and clearly get them to understand that you don't learn much in school. That you're training your mind so that it can absorb and understand what they're doing. Because by the time you get out of school, the things you have learned in the way of facts of the subjects in which you're studying become obsolete. And so if you're training your mind to think in an engineering or scientific manner, then when you come and face the realities of life, you've got to adjust your thinking to handle those situations. So it is really the training of the method of thinking, whether it is scientific or engineering, and there's a difference. between the scientific mind and the engineering mind. And I was trained as a scientist and secondary as an economist. And almost everything I had to do involved economics and or engineering and science.
So it was the ways of thinking that...
That make you, you're much better able to handle the changes in situation. I can remember as I went in, particularly when I was in the Army, and they'd give me a new job to do. Things changed. As I will show you at one point. I always bucked the change. I didn't want to change. I didn't see how I could possibly have any knowledge or ability to be able to handle a job that I'd never heard of before. And but you had to go in there, you had to do it, because you couldn't say no. If the boss says you can't do this, you go do it. And
This whole part of your career, it seems to me, you were doing things that had never been done before by anybody. I mean, the mobilization, there had been some mobilization for the First World War, but nothing like this.
Remember, we had Bonnie Baruch came down. And he did in the First World War what Don Nelson did in the Second World War.
So he was your link with the past.
In my link with the past. Uh-huh. And having spent several days with him,
mm-hmm.
and then later on, other periods, and being associated with people who knew him very well and followed him. He gave us great advice about how he went about doing it in the First World War.
Still, there must have been vast differences.
Yeah. Oh, there was. But in the meantime, the Army Industrial College had kept those studies going,
mm-hmm.
which resulted in the warrant plan that I told you about. It turned into the CMP, or the Controlled Materials Plan. And that was the plan that we worked with, so that I had been apprised and studied that before I even sat down to do any work in the Army. And my academic training would have trained my mind to be able to absorb that particular problem, even though I'd never heard of it before.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I get into handling the aluminum situation, and suddenly Vince Austin says, you're the chairman of a committee that's got to get aluminum going, or interdepartmental committee. I've never heard of the names of things that you did in order to put aluminum to use. Rolling into sheet, drawing it into tube, or bar, and casting it into castings, forging it in with big hammers to pound it and do it. Why you all did all this? I've never quite any courses in metallurgy, but it didn't take me long to understand what it was. And then I became, although I never went out and did these things, I became fairly expert. I could understand what was going on and why these things were needed.
Okay, so your need to know this was only so that you could have a reasonable expectation of how long it took?
And that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for instance, when I told you that we had the aluminum committee, we mm-hmm. found out how many airplanes we needed to produce, and we went to the people who knew, and they told us how many tons of this mm-hmm. and how many tons of that would be required to build an airplane, or pounds.
And you had to know whether what they were saying was reasonable or
that's
not.
That's right.
Mm, I see.
That's why I'd be useful. Usually sitting in a meeting where people didn't have that kind of a training, and so my mind could would be able to fathom those questions.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's what you mean by whether or not you can use your training. But the important thing is to train your mind to think. And I often said to my students and scholars, now, if I train you to make one to have one thought in this course, and I've been successful in as your professor.
Yeah. The fact they can look up later.
Yeah.
I mean, they can always
look up. And at Caltech, we had an honor system. We could take our books in with us, and the problems were given to us. We weren't supposed to remember all the formulae and things like this, but how do you solve this particular problem in this particular subject? And that trains your mind to think that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a little impatient with people who go wandering all over the place and don't have any. And sometimes I've got a reputation of being a little impatient.
How do you? Were you more patient than General Clay or less?
Oh, no, I suppose we were about the same. The more I've thought about this, that you've raised this question about my association with Clay, we thought alike.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't as smart as he was, and by any means, and but we had the same mental approach, so we could communicate without structuring sentences and things like that. A few words we'd understand each other, and we didn't have to waste a lot of time talking about it. And but quickly, I could go in and I'd say, well, these are the facts and the situation. What we do about it, and have a suggestion, because his mind he was trained as an engineer too, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the West Pointers are engineers.
Right. Now, did he have a similar relationship with his superior, do you know?
With Somerville?
Uh huh.
Oh, I expect so. Somerville was an engineer too.
He was also.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and you're a.
He and Somerville got along. Well, they were two strong minds, and there would be some conflict, but it didn't interfere. Now, for instance, Somerville went on a trip to Africa, and he saw that they took the wooden boxes that the food came in and used that for firewood, and he thought that was wonderful, and so he said, we ought to put all our quartermaster supplies in wooden boxes. So Clay bought some boxes made of wood that had been tossed off the side of the ship and showed what the result was, and had one that was in these cartons, which they made these multi-leaf cartons, and they threw that off the same place where they did the show off a factory wall, and they survived. And Somerville had issued the order they would do this, and so Clay had him come and see what in his office. I was there when he came up from there. And Somerville had the integrity and the knowledge to be able to say, well, we'll change it. I took a colonel or a civilian who was colonel in the international division, where we had to prepare for having the supplies available when the armies went in, so they had the medical take care of the people as they liberated areas. Mm-hmm. We had to be prepared to do that. And we had a whole division that worked on it. And General Somerville went to a lend-lease meeting, and what he agreed with the British to do, we simply couldn't do. I can't remember the details of it now, and I didn't know it then, this colonel did. So Clay was traveling around the world somewhere, so I took the colonel down to see General Somerville. And this colonel explained to the general what had gone wrong with this procedure. And let me see how it went about. I thought, well, he is telling this great man that he was wrong. But some of them didn't say that, it was worrying. He said, all right, Colonel, what does I do to do right? And the colonel told him what to do right. He said, well, go do it. I mean, that's the kind of mental atmosphere in which I work. And that trained me as an executive.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go telling people. It used to annoy me when I get into industry to have people come into me and say, well, what do you want me to do in this thing? I said, what do I want you to do? You've got this job. What is it in your job is the right thing for our company to do? You advise me, not me and I tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to do. People, they want somebody else to tell them what to do.
Right. Get information to flow up is very difficult sometimes.
That's part of being the executive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, although people accuse General Clay of being a Caesar type, and he was pretty firm in his opinions, but nevertheless, when someone pointed out that he was wrong, there was no trouble for him to change and do it the right way. But he was pretty firm when he was pretty sure of himself, and he was more sure of himself than most people I know, because he knew more. His mind was terribly retentive. I told you about the reports I gave him.
Brilliant mind. Mm-hmm. Now, when you got into Germany then, and were doing that, now this was something that had not been done before. You didn't have many guidelines for that, did
well,
you?
Well, the only guideline we had was JCS 1067.
And it seems to me, in a sense, this whole thing was contradictory, because JC 1067 wanted to keep Germany an agrarian nation, didn't it? And yet you were bringing in, they had U.S. Steel and these great people to
My big trouble there in Germany was to keep these big industrialists on my staff from running German industry. And our job was to get the Germans to run their industry, not to come and do it for them.
But essentially, isn't there a contradiction here that you were developing industry at all when the policy
I don't think so, because remember, we were still fighting with Japan, and our country had been badly upset by the fact that we were concentrated on the war economy. It would have to be turned over. The Germans have to take care of themselves, otherwise we would be in there supplying forever. And our job, and Clay was very clear about this, and we had to battle with it sometimes over with the State Department, to get the concept across that we don't go in there and run this country, that they've got to do it themselves. What we had to do is get the Nazi mentality out of the picture.
Nice. But there was no sense that there should be no German industry. It was to be developed.
This brings up one thing that we haven't talked about. While we were there, a California oil man I'm trying to remember his name now, went to Moscow and worked out a deal with the Russians on reparations. And when he came back from Moscow, he sat down with me and Bill Draper, this gentleman up behind me, and one or two others, and we were just horrified what he had agreed to do.
Which was what?
We were going to get a level of industry which Germany would be allowed to develop, which would be no greater than the lowest level of all the countries that they had around them, that they'd attacked. We could never get the Russians to give us what their level of industry was, how many ounces of food they ate a year, calories, and how many pairs of shoes, and how many things like this. What was the allowance to be given? So we had to do it on our own, but we did know more about the French, and we did know more about the Belgians, and so forth. But we went to allow Germany to build an industry which would go beyond that level. That was the level of industry. There was a level of industry committee which I sat on in Berlin. Well,